You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Double Down by Ben Mezrich. In 2009, when I published The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, which was adapted into the film The Social Network, I could never have guessed that one day I would revisit two of the characters from that story, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss, the identical twins who challenged Mark Zuckerberg over the origins of what would soon be one of the most powerful companies on Earth. In the world, The Accidental Billionaires was published into Facebook was the revolution, and Mark Zuckerberg, the revolutionary. He was attempting to change the social order, how society interacted, and how people met, communicated, fell in love, and lived. The Winklevoss twins appeared to be his perfect foils, buttoned-down men of Harvard, privileged jocks, who in many ways, easy to see, represented the establishment. 6'5" Olympic rowers, chiseled members of the ultimate undergraduate finals club, the Porcellian, the Winklevi were the cool kids on campus, suited entities that seemed to have been created by a Hollywood casting studio. But 10 years later, the dynamic has remarkably changed. Mark Zuckerberg is now a household name. Facebook is ubiquitous, dominating much of the internet, even as it seems to be constantly embroiled in scandals, ranging from hacked user data to fake news items and providing a platform for political-based disruptions. Meanwhile, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss have also reappeared in the news in an unexpected way as leaders of an entirely new digital revolution. Having dived headlong into the wild, complex, sometimes sinister world of Bitcoin, the twins have emerged at the center of a movement that has the potential not only to decentralize money itself, but also to succeed where Facebook failed, allowing a form of online communication that is protected from hackers and overarching authority, a method of interaction that is entirely and truly free. The irony of the situation is not lost on me. Not only that Zuckerberg's and the twins' roles as the rebels versus the evil empire seem to have been reversed, but also that the accidental billionaires and the film that followed helped enshrine an image of the twins that is in desperate need of revision. It is now my opinion that Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss didn't just happen to be standing in the exact right place at the exact right time, twice. Second acts in literature, as in life, are rare. And yet, there is every chance that the Winklevoss twins' second act, the one that began shortly after their contentious settlement with Facebook, when they found the doors to Silicon Valley closed to them and instead founded the crypto asset trading platform Gemini, immersed themselves in the world of Bitcoin and emerged with a $1 billion return on their investment, will eventually overshadow their first. I believe that Bitcoin and the technology behind it have the capacity to upend the internet. Just as Facebook was developed to enable social networks to move from the physical world to the virtual one, cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin were developed for a financial landscape that now functions largely online. Bitcoin may have been a bubble. During last year's cryptocurrency crash, Bitcoin lost nearly a third of its value in just 1 week. But the technology behind it isn't a fad or a scheme. It's a fundamental paradigm shift, and it will eventually change everything. Still, rather than untethering the twins from their perpetual nemesis, Even this new chapter in their lives is inextricably tied to those early years and to what Tyler and Cameron continue to see as the multiple betrayals inflicted on them by their former college colleague. For the Winklevi, there is always one beginning, one catalyst, one driving force. The guy waiting in that San Francisco conference room. Walking into the fishbowl 40 minutes later was one of the most surreal moments in Cameron Winklevoss's life. Mark Zuckerberg was already seated at the long rectangular table in the center of the room. It seemed to Cameron that his 5-foot-7-inch frame was propped up on a thick extra cushion placed on his chair, a billionaire's booster seat. Cameron felt vaguely self-conscious as he closed the glass door behind him. He could see Tyler and their lawyer taking seats on the other side of the soundproof glass. Farther down the hall, he saw Piazza, and then Zuckerberg's lawyers, an army of men in suits. Even so close, the distance felt palpable. The conversation would be between Cameron and Zuckerberg. No mediator, no lawyers, nobody listening in, nobody to get in their way. Zuckerberg didn't look up as Cameron approached the other end of the conference table. The strange chill running down Cameron's spine had little to do with the overzealous air conditioning. This was the first time he and his former Harvard classmate had seen each other in 4 years. Cameron had first met Zuckerberg in the Kirkland Dining Hall in October of 2003, when he, Tyler, and their friend Divya Narendra sat down with him to discuss the social network that they had been building over the previous year. Over the next 3 months, the four of them met several more times in Zuckerberg's dorm room and exchanged more than 50 emails discussing the site. However, unbeknownst to the twins and Narendra at the time, Zuckerberg had secretly started working on another social network. In fact, he registered the domain name thefacebook.com on January 11, 2004, 4 days prior to their third meeting. 3 weeks later, he launched thefacebook.com. Cameron, Tyler, and Narendra only learned about it while reading the campus paper, the Harvard Crimson. Cameron soon confronted Zuckerberg over email. Zuckerberg responded, "If you would like to meet to discuss any of this, I am willing to meet with you alone. Let me know." But Cameron had passed, feeling the trust had been irreparably damaged. What good could come of trying to reason with someone who was capable of acting the way he did? The only thing Cameron felt that they could do at that point was rely on the system. First, by petitioning the Harvard administration and Harvard President Larry Summers to step in and enforce the honor codes pertaining to student interactions clearly delineated in the student handbook, and then, when that failed, reluctantly turning to the courts. And now, here they were, 4 long years later. Cameron reached the table and lowered his oversized frame into one of the chairs before Zuckerberg finally looked up, the tiniest sliver of an awkward smile touching his lips. It was incredibly hard to read someone who had no discernible facial expressions, but Cameron thought he detected a hint of nervousness in the way his old schoolmate rocked forward, his legs crossed beneath the table at the ankles, a mere glimmer of human emotion. Surprisingly, he was not wearing his signature gray hoodie. Perhaps he was finally taking this seriously. Zuckerberg nodded at Cameron, mumbling some sort of greeting. Over the next 10 minutes, Cameron did most of the talking. He started by extending an olive branch. He congratulated Zuckerberg on all that he had accomplished over the years since Harvard. How he turned the Facebook.com, a college-based social network that had started as a small, exclusive website connecting Harvard kids with one another, into Facebook, a worldwide phenomenon that would eventually draw in more than 1/5 of the population worldwide. Cameron held himself back from stating the obvious. He, Tyler, and Narendra believed, deeply and firmly, that Facebook had actually risen out of their own idea, a social networking site initially called Harvard Connection, later renamed ConnectU, that was aimed at helping college students connect with one another online. Narendra and the twins had designed ConnectU based on their shared epiphany that a person's email address was not only a good way to authenticate their identity, but also a good proxy for his or her real-life social network. The Harvard Registrar issues @harvard.edu email addresses only to Harvard students. Goldman Sachs issues @goldmansachs.com email addresses only to Goldman Sachs employees. This framework would give the ConnectU network an integrity that other social networks, such as Friendster and MySpace, lacked. It would organize users in a way that allowed them to find one another more easily and connect in a more meaningful way. It was, in fact, the same framework that would soon launch the sophomore computer science major they hired into worldwide fame and internet dominance. In the twins' opinion, the only networks Zuckerberg was familiar with were computer ones. From their own social interactions with him, it was clear that Zuckerberg was more comfortable talking with machines than with people. Seen this way, it actually made a lot more sense if the world's biggest social network was in fact the offspring of an unlikely marriage between the twins and Zuckerberg. As opposed to Zuckerberg's brainchild alone, the idea of the solitary genius who invents something brilliant all by himself is the stuff of movies, a Hollywood myth. In reality, the greatest companies in the world were started by dynamic duos. Jobs and Wozniak, Brin and Page, Gates and Allen. The list went on and on, and Cameron believed should have included Zuckerberg and the Winklevosses, or the Winklevosses and Zuckerberg. Next photo, suits. Tyler Winklevoss and Cameron Winklevoss leave the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, 2011. Sitting at that conference table, Cameron had to acknowledge to himself that what Zuckerberg had done was truly impressive. Whatever he'd taken from them, he'd grown it into a true revolution, and so Cameron made sure to tell him so. He talked about how what Zuckerberg had created was incredible, the sort of innovation that happened maybe once in a generation. When Cameron paused, Zuckerberg added his own congratulations. He seemed genuinely impressed that Cameron and Tyler had become national rowing champions while at Harvard and were now in a position to make the U.S. Olympic rowing team and compete for gold at the Beijing Olympics that summer. Oddly, he reminded Cameron of the timid kid they had first met in the dining hall back at Harvard, a socially awkward computer jock who was elated to step into their orbit even for a moment. Cameron did his best to chase dark thoughts away as he took in the compliments. He tried not to remember what it had felt like to read about Zuckerberg's website in the Harvard Crimson. Going down that mental path wouldn't do him any good. None of that really mattered now. Glancing back at his brother and the men sitting outside the glass fishbowl, Cameron kept his emotions in check. "Mark, let's bury the hatchet. Let's let bygones be bygones. We're not saying we created Facebook. At least we agree on something. An attempt at humor. Cameron couldn't be sure, but plugged along anyway. We're not saying we deserve 100%. We're saying we deserve more than 0%. Zuckerberg nodded. "Can you really say that you would be sitting where you are today if we hadn't approached you?" "I'm sitting here today because you're suing me. You know what I mean." "I know what you think you mean." "We approached you with our idea. We gave you unfettered access to our entire code base. I saw that light bulb turn on inside your head." You weren't the first person in the world to have an idea for a social network, and neither was I. Friendster and MySpace existed before Facebook, and last time I checked, Tom from MySpace isn't suing me. Exhausting. Exasperating. Cameron pressed his calloused fingers against the boardroom table between them. He pictured an oar being pulled through the water, stroke after stroke after stroke. This could go on forever, and it's not doing either of us any good. I'm a person, you're a person. You've got a company to run, and we have an Olympic team to make. Again, something we agree on. Life is too short to keep going back and forth like this. Zuckerberg paused, then pointed to the lawyers through the glass behind them. They might disagree. Let's find some common ground, shake hands, and move on with our lives to the great things we all have ahead of us. Zuckerberg stared at him for a full beat. He appeared as though he was about to say something else, but instead simply twitched and again attempted the briefest of smiles. Then, in a manner that could only be called robotic, Zuckerberg reached across the table and offered what appeared to be an attempt at a handshake. Cameron felt the hair rise on the back of his neck. Was this really happening? The conversation hadn't seemed to be getting anywhere. And yet, out of the corner of his eye, he could see Zuckerberg's lawyers behind the glass rising to their feet. Cameron reached out and shook Mark Zuckerberg's hand. And without another word, the Facebook CEO hopped off his chair and headed for the door. Cameron had no idea what was going through his inscrutable head. Maybe Cameron had somehow reached him, and he decided to finally give the Winklevoss twins what they believed they deserved. $65 million! Calamari, their lawyer, was nearly shouting at them. He held the one-page handwritten settlement offer in one hand and a slice of pizza in the other. This is incredible! Don't you see that this is incredible? Teardrops of melted cheese were falling from the end of the pizza as he waved it toward the twins. Tyler stared at the settlement offer. $65 million sounded great, until you juxtaposed it with Zuckerberg's slice of Facebook's $15 billion valuation. There's something missing here, Tyler started, when Calamari cut him off, that damn pizza swinging so hard it threatened to break free from the man's fingers and rocket toward the twins. Are you kidding? Guys, it's Christmas in February. He's agreed to settle, and it's a fortune. Tyler looked at Cameron, who appeared just as exasperated as he felt. Sure, Zuckerberg had offered to settle. As stubborn as he was probably always going to settle. Even if deep down the Facebook CEO didn't think the Winklevosses' claims had merit, they had always assumed that he knew they had enough evidence. The atmospherics alone were plenty, and then there were the emails. There were a lot of emails, and the twins thought they were damaging enough to tie Zuckerberg up in knots and turn him into a human pretzel on the stand. A public trial had to be too risky to consider. Fraud was not something to leave to 12 jurors to decide. Worse yet, Zuckerberg knew that the other side was pushing to see the messages revealed through forensic discovery, electronic imaging of his computer's hard drive, the same computer he'd used back at Harvard. As the twins would later find out, Zuckerberg had good reason not to want to let that happen. In 2012, Facebook would seek an IPO, and the last thing Zuckerberg or Facebook's board of directors needed before offering its stock to the public was the unearthing of potentially damning documents, including the trove of now infamous instant messages that Zuckerberg had written while he was a student at Harvard. Some of them were to Adam D'Angelo, a friend and talented computer programmer who had attended Caltech and was now Facebook's CTO. These messages had been discovered during a forensic analysis of Zuckerberg's hard drive, but at the time of the Winklevoss mediation, Zuckerberg's attorney, Neil Chatterjee, had yet to turn them over. It was years after he settled with the twins that the IMs found their way onto the Internet by way of a particularly intrepid journalist at Business Insider, Nicholas Carlson, and only then that Cameron and Tyler would get a look at the taunting notes detailing the various ways Zuckerberg planned to F them, as he wrote in one message, probably in the ear. In legal terms, the IMs may have occupied a gray area. They were not a smoking gun, but they were still dangerous. With respect to Zuckerberg's moral character, however, they were less gray than black and white. When in another IM, he told a friend, "You can be unethical and still be legal. That's the way I live my life." He was voicing a philosophy that would make future Facebook stockholders rightly nervous. And there was more. After being left in the lurch by Zuckerberg and surprised by the launch of Facebook on February 4, 2004, the twins and their friend Narendra scrambled to find programmers to finish ConnectU, which finally went live on May 21, 2004. To add insult to injury, Zuckerberg then hacked ConnectU and created another Cameron Winklevoss account. "We copied his account like his profile and everything," he wrote to a friend, "except I made his answers all like white supremacist. Under hometown," he'd written, "I'm effing privileged. Where do you think I'm from?" Under favorite quote, "Homeless people are worth their weight in paperclips. I hate black people." If he had indeed hacked into the website he was supposed to have helped build, in the twins' opinion, Zuckerberg had potentially violated federal law. And the fake profile was just the start. In other IMs, Zuckerberg bragged about further hacking ConnectU's code and deactivating user accounts just for fun. In the spring of 2004, Cameron sent an email to the tips inbox of the Harvard Crimson to notify them about Zuckerberg's duplicitous behavior. A reporter named Tim McGinn was assigned to the story and began to investigate. As Cameron was later informed, Zuckerberg went into the Harvard Crimson offices to explain his side to McGinn and an editor, Elizabeth Theodore, initially convincing them not to run with the story. But when they later decided to publish a piece on the dispute, Zuckerberg reportedly hacked into Crimson staffers' Harvard email accounts by looking in the Facebook database for their account passwords in hopes that they had used the same passwords for their Facebook accounts as they did for their Harvard email accounts. He also reviewed Facebook logs for all of their failed login attempts, thinking that they had at some point mistakenly entered their Harvard email account passwords into Facebook when trying to log in. When Business Insider published these findings, Facebook's response read in part, "We're not going to debate the disgruntled litigants and anonymous sources who seek to rewrite Facebook's early history or embarrass Mark Zuckerberg with dated allegations." The existence of that hard drive from Zuckerberg's college computer must have meant he'd never risk a trial, and not just because his IMs regarding the twins would blemish his sterling reputation as a boy wonder CEO. They would call into question the very basis of the revolution he was creating. "If you ever need info about anyone at Harvard," he wrote to a friend, "just ask. I have over 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses, SNS. People just submitted it. I don't know why they trust me, dumb F's." "This is bullshit," Tyler said, still looking at the paper covered in chicken scratch. "We deserve to be rightful owners." Calamari was still grinning over his celebratory pizza. He had just finished a call with John Quinn, the Quinn and Quinn Emanuel, presumably to brag about the potential settlement result. But to Tyler, this wasn't about money. This had never been about money. as Zuckerberg had so delicately pointed out in the fake profile he'd made of Cameron, Tyler and Cameron had been born into money. But what Zuckerberg didn't know was that their father had built that privileged childhood for them through sweat, brains, and character. He'd propelled himself upward from a heritage of hard-working German immigrants, a family of coal miners, and he'd made it his mission to instill in the brothers a sense of right and wrong so strict that it could often be blinding. Winning didn't matter if it didn't happen the right way, for the right reasons. Tyler simply couldn't just walk away, not even for $65 million in cash. "We'll take it in stock," he said suddenly. Cameron nodded. Calamari's face blanched. "Are you crazy? You want to invest in that putz?" Calamari exclaimed. Immediately, he and his team embarked on a campaign to convince Tyler and Cameron that they were being foolish, batshit crazy, that they should take the cash and run. But in the twins' minds, taking stock was a way of going back in time and righting a wrong. As founders who hadn't been cut out by Zuckerberg, they would have had stock. Here, after all these years, was their chance to get back, at least in part, to where they should have started. Ultimately, the twins and their lawyers reached a compromise. The twins would take $20 million in cash and the rest of the $65 million settlement in stock. Quinn Emanuel would take its fee, about $13 million in cash. After Facebook's IPO, the twins' $45 million in shares soared. Adjusted for splits, it appreciated 5 times, and according to the twins, went on to be worth almost $500 million. If Quinn Emanuel had taken its fee in stock, the firm would have earned upward of $100 million for 6 months of work. For the foolish, batshit crazy twins, this proved to be one of the greatest business decisions of all time, topped only, perhaps, by their choice to invest $11 million of that settlement in Bitcoin in 2013. But back in 2008, the saga was far from over. Shortly after they'd settled, it emerged that the twins were missing critical information related to the value of the stock they had received. An internal document known as a 409A valuation, which had been created by an independent third-party firm. This valuation, which Facebook used to comply with IRS rules and the U.S. tax code, valued the twins' Facebook shares at a quarter of the price that Zuckerberg's settlement offer had told them they were worth. Was it another ear-effing? Armed with both the valuation and the knowledge of the damaging IMs that would eventually come out via Business Insider, the twins tried to get the case reopened. In a 2010 appeals brief, Facebook denied any misrepresentation. The twins' effort was shot down by a California federal judge, a verdict that was later upheld by the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The result wasn't surprising. The twins were fighting Facebook, soon to be a $100 billion monster in its own backyard. The stakes had become enormous. President Obama had visited Facebook's headquarters after being elected in 2008. A win credited in part to Zuckerberg's site, which Obama's campaign had used to connect with millions of voters dubbed the Facebook generation. And it didn't hurt that one of Obama's campaign gurus was Chris Hughes, Zuckerberg's former roommate, who had run marketing and communications for Facebook prior to joining the Obama campaign. This all culminated with Zuckerberg's adorning the cover of Time magazine in 2010 as Person of the Year. Battling a tech colossus in California did not exactly get you favorable odds. The Winklevoss twins believed Zuckerberg had wronged them in 2004 by stealing their idea for what became Facebook, had wronged them a second time by deep-sixing the damaging IMs during litigation, and had wronged them a third time by lying about Facebook's stock valuation. By winning, they had lost. Despite receiving stock potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars, an enormous sum by any standard, the twins felt maligned. And not only that, going up against Zuckerberg in such a public fashion had taken its toll on their image in the court of public opinion. They were torn apart in the media and ridiculed by the blogosphere as spoiled and entitled brats with a nasty case of sour grapes. Whereas each time another example of Zuckerberg's Shakespearean betrayals became public, the media seemed to look the other way. Even Larry Summers, the former president of Harvard, took a shot at them, publicly calling them assholes while on stage at Fortune's 2011 Brainstorm Tech Conference, hosted at the Aspen Institute. The twins' offense? Wearing jackets and ties when they'd attended President Summers' office hours in April 2004 to discuss Zuckerberg's duplicitous behavior. Summers' public attack seemed so unfair that the twins and Narendra wrote an open letter to Summers' successor, then Harvard President Drew Gilpin Faust, expressing their concerns regarding Summers' conduct. It was not his failure to shake hands with the three of us upon entering his office. Doing so would have required him to take his feet off his desk and stand up from his chair, nor his tenor that was most alarming, but rather his scorn for a genuine discourse on deeper ethical questions, Harvard's honor code, and its applicability or lack thereof, they wrote, going on to add, "It goes without saying that every student should feel free to bring issues forward, dress how they see fit, or express themselves without fear of prejudice or public disparagement from a fellow member of the community, much less so from a faculty member." Perhaps it was no surprise that Summers' tenure as president of Harvard had been quick and judged by many to be a failure. In January 2005, at an academic conference on diversity in the sciences and engineering, he called into question the innate aptitude of women as compared with men in the sciences. 2 months later, the Harvard faculty passed a no-confidence vote in his leadership, and on February 21, 2006, Summers announced his resignation. After his departure, Summers landed a job in the Obama administration and managed to find his way onto a few boards of tech companies, including Square. This was thanks to some help from Sheryl Sandberg, who had joined Facebook as its chief operating officer in 2008. She was a former student of Summers and later worked for him when he was Secretary of the Treasury under President Clinton. Perhaps Summers' friendship with Sandberg had inspired him to lean in against the twins and try to even the score. Who knew? "No matter how many times we win this race," Cameron said, "it isn't going to matter." He was right. They had ended up with a vast amount of money, but to the world, they were losers. Even standing on an Olympic podium wasn't going to get them any sense of justice. They would just be dumb jocks who rode off into the sunset. "It's not personal," one of their lawyers had told them. "It's business." But it had never been just business between them and Zuckerberg. It had always been personal, and they had lost. If they wanted to change that narrative, they needed to go back to the arena where it had all started and begin the fight all over again. Queen Mom. After rising to fame by mining pregnancy and motherhood for comic gold, Ali Wong is primed to rule the comedy world. By Julie Miller. Photographs by Mark Seliger. Styled by Colleen Atwood. Opening photo, court jester, Ali Wong, photographed in Los Angeles. The new Netflix movie, Always Be My Maybe, which comedian Ali Wong co-wrote and stars in, a pregnant character, side-eyes the pristine post-delivery photo op Kate Middleton gave the world in 2013. Hours after giving birth to Prince George, the future queen consort had posed with perfect makeup and a professional blowout in a cornflower blue dress and wedge heels, looking like she had at most indulged in a heavy lunch. "And I am so mad at Kate Middleton. She had that royal diaper on. You know, she had that diaper on," the character says, referring to the same unsightly, previously unspoken-of accessory Wong gets real about in her 2018 Netflix stand-up special, Hard Knock Wife, which she taped while 7 months pregnant with her second child. "Nobody told me about all the crazy shit that comes out after you give birth," Wong says, leaning into the audience and lowering her voice to riff on another savage secret of womanhood. "You know what happens after the baby comes out? You know what else exits?" A pause. Her house, her living room, her pillows, the Bob Marley poster, all the food that went bad in her refrigerator for months. So then you have to wear this cartoonishly large pad that's like the size of a toddler mattress. In a world where real-life princesses are still radiating perfection from actual palaces, it's nice that Ali Wong has not only made a career demolishing such facades, but is thriving by doing so. As she said in 2016's Baby Cobra, her first Netflix special, the one that made her a comedy star and the Eddie Murphy of OBGYN offices, "It's very rare and unusual to see a female comic perform pregnant, because female comics don't get pregnant. Once they do, they generally disappear." Wong's joke may seem like hyperbole, but a quick spin through the history of mothers and Major League American stand-up returns limited results, with Roseanne Barr and Joan Rivers as the obvious exceptions. Wong, 36, has worked in television as well. She was a staff writer on ABC's Fresh Off the Boat and co-starred on 3 seasons of the network's American Housewife while being anything but. But now that her career is entering the land of movie deals and memoirs and potential superstardom, Wong is insistent that she stay true to her stand-up roots, even with 2 small children in tow. "Back when 100 million people would watch television, the dream for a comic would be landing a sitcom like Jerry Seinfeld or Ray Romano did," Wong tells me. "Now I look at the landscape, watered down by streaming companies and countless viewing options, and I'm like, I think I got my dream, which is to tour and take my family with me." Wong's devotion to her daughters has dictated her professional decisions, proving that it is possible to be both a warm, devoted mother and a wicked, razor-sharp wit. Imagine Jennifer Garner getting on stage at the Comedy Cellar and killing like Dave Chappelle. Wong, a San Francisco native, plans family art projects for daughters Mary, now 3, and Nikki, now 1, and gives them haircuts at home. "They look like Velma Kelly," she says, showing me a picture of the girls and their matching Chicago-style bobs. She took pains to book her current Milk and Money tour around Mary's school schedule. Her forthcoming book, Dear Girls, a compilation of essays about what Wong calls her crazy years, is addressed directly to her daughters, as its title suggests. As Mary and Nikki grow up, Wong continues to blow up stereotypes, parenting double standards and antiquated stigmas, clearing a path for future generations of less inhibited female comics. Perhaps the greatest testament to her plan to counter her own observation about the absence of mothers in stand-up is the fact that she made sure each daughter had her own in utero Netflix special. No more kids, she assures me. There will be more specials. Wong moves on stage with the easy swagger of Mick Jagger. Had he been Freaky Friday'd into the body of a no-fuss, 5-foot Vietnamese Chinese-American woman who knows how to set up her own eucalyptus diffuser backstage. In person, at a vegan cafe in Culver City, Wong is a softer, more inquisitive version of this stage persona. She's also smaller, a detail I don't realize until I compliment her on her cream-colored jumpsuit, and she bolts out of the booth like a children's size 13-14 stick of dynamite. Guess where it's from, she says, twirling in her bargain buy, paired with black Gucci slides, robin's egg blue nails, and her signature cat's eye glasses. Zara, kids, it's better standing up, she explains, since it's meant for the torso of a person who's hitting puberty and a little tight around the crotch area. I meet her on a Friday afternoon in February, and she freely admits, before our appetizers even arrive, that she and her husband of nearly 5 years, Justin Hakuta, were in couples therapy earlier that day. We go to deal with all sorts of transitions, she tells me, alluding to the recalibration required in a marriage when one spouse becomes famous. When I say it's refreshing to hear someone talk frankly about couples therapy, she shrugs. People are worried about other people thinking something's wrong in your relationship, she says, and it's like something is wrong in every relationship. So if you're not willing to admit that something is wrong, then something is wrong with you. In Hard Knock Wife, Wong addresses with candor the fact that she is now the family breadwinner. My mom is very concerned. My husband's going to leave me out of intimidation, she says. I had to explain to her that the only kind of man that would leave a woman who makes more money is the kind of man that doesn't like free money. Wong's fearless approach to such uncomfortable but relatable material has enchanted all demographics. She plays everywhere, Wong's mentor Chris Rock tells me. Everybody kind of loves Ali Wong. And he's right. On her current tour, Wong had to schedule 10 back-to-back shows at the Wiltern in Los Angeles and another 10 at the Masonic in San Francisco to meet audience demand. The manager at the bistro we're in likes her so much that he waives the bill. Even though, Wong jokes, the concept of comped meals freaks her out because she'll have to overpay in the tip. In 2016, after she told the New Yorker's Ariel Levy that she and her fresh-off-the-boat collaborator and longtime friend Randall Park wanted to make their own When Harry Met Sally. The internet essentially willed the project, which became Always Be My Maybe, into existence. We started getting all these calls from people like, we want to make the movie, says Wong, and we were like, we haven't even written it yet. Last year, even though Wong's manager warned her about scheduling a show in Salt Lake City on a Sunday night, how well could a comedian who has joked about anal sex do on a weekend in a largely Mormon town? Her set sold out in about 2 hours. Then, when she got to Utah and made her traditional tour stop pilgrimage to find Asian food, it gives me a sense of comfort and it's the best. She ended up sitting inside a noodle shop in the Utah capital's tiny Asian enclave, where the Mandarin-speaking owner turned out to be a fan. As she loaded the table with free appetizer after free appetizer, she told Wong, I can't believe you're here. Which Wong could only understand because her good friend comedian Shang Wang was there and able to translate. I couldn't believe this lady who doesn't speak English, who owns this small noodle shop in Salt Lake City, knew who I was, says Wong. I invited her to my show. She made her husband go back to the restaurant to work in her place. We had a great time. Keanu Reeves loves Wong so much that after she reached out to his people with a long shot ask, would the very busy movie star appear in the aforementioned rom-com, and not, by the way, as the male lead, he not only agreed, but requested an audience with her, in which he quoted some of her stand-up and launched into an impromptu martial arts interpretation of her specials. Exceedingly modest, she only admits this after I press her for details of the meeting. I watched both specials. You took no prisoners, Wong recalls Reeves saying. You were like, she gestures, karate chopping the air, then mimes biting a grenade and throwing it. When the invitation came to act with Ali in her film, I was honored, Reeves tells me in an email, to have had the opportunity to work with such a brave, talented artist and great person was a joy and inspiring. Reeves' commitment to the role and Wong is wonderfully apparent in his laugh-out-loud scenes. He gives great comedic gusto. So, yes, in the words of Chris Rock, everybody kind of loves Ali Wong. If kind of is a superstitious qualifier, Rock uses to ward off bad luck for his protege. When Rock first met Wong, she was riding full-time on Fresh Off the Boat and driving around after hours to various clubs for what was essentially her second full-time job, perfecting her routine. When she was expecting her first daughter, she was nervous, as most pregnant career women are, that the baby might mark the end of her professional life. But Rock sensed it was just the beginning and reassured her. With the exception of Eddie Murphy and, like, Pete Davidson now, there's not really that many young comedians, he tells me. There's no Justin Bieber lane of comedy. It doesn't work that way. So you find success generally from grown-ups. They're young grown-ups, but grown-ups. So I told her the kid's only going to help. Marriage only helps. Life only helps. Wong's clocked plenty of such adult experience in the last 3 years. In addition to birthing and caring for two humans, recovering from two C-sections, adjusting to motherhood, and co-starring on 3 seasons of American Housewife, she wrote Dear Girls and a new stand-up act, voiced Netflix's Tuca and Birdie with Tiffany Haddish, and co-wrote, produced, and starred in Always Be My Maybe. She doesn't just sit back and wait for the world to discover her, Fresh Off the Boat showrunner Nanachka Khan says of Wong's work ethic. She's constantly trying to get better and perfecting her craft in all elements, whether it's writing or performing. She's been so busy that the wildness of this roller coaster only seemed to crystallize for Wong and her husband recently, when both Lauryn Hill and Kobe Bryant introduced themselves as fans at one of Hill's concerts. Your life has changed, Hakuta told her, before correcting himself. Our lives have changed. Ask whether Hakuta has any issue or insecurity around his wife's suddenly palling around with the likes of Reeves, Wong says. I hang out with the most professionally funny men in the world. So, he had to deal with that a long time ago. He's very proud, but he's kind of like, I think he finds it more surreal. The key for them, according to Wong, has been staying mindful and conscious of how we are feeling through these transitions. But he's happy. Even though taking a family on tour sounds daunting, I get the sense that for Wong, traveling from one city and stand-up venue to the next is more comfortable than sitting stationary in her bubbling fame. It's given us the opportunity to spend a lot of quality time together as a family, she says. Later, when I ask Rock about the intimidating logistics of taking a family on tour, he waves off my skepticism. Diana Ross did it when she was on the road, he points out. Country music stars do it. Once you get out of the clubs and are playing concert venues, you're just a performer. You're playing the same venues as musicians. While Wong was filming Always Be My Maybe, Hakuda, who was still working in Los Angeles, flew to Vancouver every weekend to be with the family. That's a crazy amount of support, Wong points out. During previous stand-up tours, Hakuda has even taken his husbandly commitment to the next level, working Wong's merch booth, selling T-shirts and swag to fans. Hakuda recently left his job as vice president of product at GoodRx. Wong explores this modern romantic dynamic in Always Be My Maybe, which she co-wrote with Park and Michael Golemko. She plays the successful partner in the will-they-won't-they relationship, a celebrity chef who, while sometimes isolated by the trappings of her career, is allowed to be both ambitious and vulnerable. Wong chose to play a chef based on Nikki Nakayama, the only woman featured in the first season of Netflix's Chef's Table, because it provided a close analog to the life of a female comedian. The restaurant industry, like comedy, is a very male-dominated profession, she says. The hours are at night. You're always working on weekends. So you can never go to, like, baby showers or weddings. And in terms of voice, her job as a chef is so much about constantly innovating and having a unique point of view. But at the same time, none of that matters if the food doesn't taste good, and none of that matters if the jokes aren't funny. The movie was directed by Khan, who is excited for audiences to see a new, softer side to her friend. I think people will come into this movie expecting her to be funny, but then she shows, in my opinion, such a range of emotion as an actress. I think it's going to surprise a lot of people. I was blown away by her. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.